This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. There are a few superlatives left to describe the success of Black Panther. The latest Marvel movie has received glowing reviews, broken countless records, and is nothing short of a cultural phenomenon.
I waited my entire life for this. The world's gonna start over. I'ma burn it all.
What happens now determines what happens to the rest of the world.
That's a clip from the trailer from Black Panther, and it foreshadows indeed the reach of this film. It has indeed reached far corners of the world, but what is its long-term impact? Can it finally disprove the long-standing myth that black films don't travel? One of the many topics we'll talk about today on Back Channel, our series connecting culture and context. Right now, joining me are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thank you, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Hello, Mark.
What's up, Frank?
Wow, Black Panther. What'd you think? Natalie?
Well, it was everything that I expected that it would be, given all the hype. And I have to say that I avoided reading anything, you know, like I really didn't read any of the think pieces.
So you have
or
a
reviews.
Bunker somewhere at St. Augs, 40
right,
stories deep.
Yeah, I just threw everything into my email box. You know, I knew I'd want to read it later, but it was amazing. And it was exactly what I, as a black person, need right now in this moment, given everything that is happening, you know, in this era.
The ideological discussions within the film aside, it was a 2.5 hour break from reality to enjoy the beauty of the black imagination, to enjoy the beauty of black minds, of black beauty, black bodies, black style, in ways that I think is really unprecedented in terms of Hollywood film.
Yeah.
And not just African-American, but Africa is portrayed in this in a way that we have not seen recently.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
The idea of the uncolonialized Africa, you know, is something that, you know, it is truly Afrofuturism in that context.
Absolutely.
You know, I want to actually go to another clip right away and want to come back because I want to hear a clip from actress Lupita Nyong'o, who's talking on The View. And a member of the majority black cast, of course, in Black Panther. But she's talking about the significance, that the role that Wakanda and Africa play in that film.
We come from a continent of great wealth, but a continent that has been assaulted and abused
and
very
exploited.
Often. And exploited.
Yes.
Oftentimes what colonialism did is that it rewrote our history and, you know, changed our narrative. Mm-hmm. And so our narrative, our global narrative is one of poverty and strife. And the wealth of the continent is very seldom seen on such a global scale.
Yeah.
So what this film does really, it looks cool, it looks futuristic, but it's drawing from ancient cultures on the continent. And Wakanda is special because it was never colonized. So what we can see there for all of us, it's a reimagining of what would have been possible had Africa been allowed to realize itself for itself, you know?
Yes.
And that's a beautiful thing.
Lupita Nyong'o on The View, a member of the majority black cast in the new Marvel film Black Panther, Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown here. Does it change the conversation? We'll talk about, I guess, the impact this would have nationally to see Africa represented in this way, not a third world country, but a real player. What about within African-American communities? Does this change a conversation there, or is there a conversation to change about perceptions of Africa?
You know, I think in so many narratives and the criticisms of the film, well, they describe Wakanda as this fictional African country. And some commentators have raised the question, well, why does it have to be fictional? Right? Why can't we just refer to it as some sort of extension of the idea of what Africa can be? And I think for African-American audiences who are willing to invest in that, they will have a different view of Africa. But again, that's a difficult relationship because I'm not sure folks go and see Wakanda and think about Wakanda in the context of what might be their Nigerian-American neighbors or their Ghanaian-American neighbors, right? I think there are still folks in the United States, black and otherwise, who make distinctions between these super heroic black figures in Wakanda and the folks who live, you know, around the corner from them.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of, you know, and it comes from this pretty persistent representation of Africa in a certain way, in a negative way. There's a way that the African-American community in particular, I think, envisions Africa because we don't know. Most of us have not been there. And we only know what we've heard about or what we've seen on television or in movies. And so I think Mark is right that there is a way that we revel in what we see on screen, what we see about Wakanda, how diasporic culture really is celebrated through this film. But I don't think that we make the connection back to the actual place.
You know, I think in the case with African Americans and continental Africans, the exchange is different. Because, you know, in many ways, even as African Americans might be critical of American empire and American imperialism, they, in fact, reproduce African-American empire and African-American privilege as they think about. So we think about the exchange about what we can do in the United States for Africans. The film is really about what Wakanda can do for us.
Right.
And that's a logic that Black folks haven't had to consider, because when we consider the value of Africa, it's always the Africa of 1,200 years ago and what it provided for us, right? It's not what the contemporary African continent can provide for us right now.
What about the representations of women? That also was powerful in this film.
It was amazing. Yeah. I mean, you know, I need to see Black Panther maybe three or four more times before I can really, like, attach myself to everything that I think is coming at me and really process the messaging. But when I left the theater, the thing that was ringing in my mind was trust Black women. I mean, and that's a hashtag that's, you know, circulates about other things. But I really felt that very strongly after watching Black Panther, because every Black female character in this film can hold her own. She's important. She brings something really specific and, dare I say, magical to the table. And they're strong Black women. That is really important for us to see, and especially Black girls to be able to, you know, see someone that looks like them that's just excelling on all these different levels, I think is really important.
I'm here with Back Channel contributors Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, and Natalie Bullock Brown is a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. And our conversation on the state of things will continue. The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio on Back Channel today, connecting culture and context with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. We've been talking about Black Panther in our first segment, a record-breaking Marvel movie. And we closed out the last segment with music from the film. Kendrick Lamar, of course, the mastermind behind the soundtrack, which is now in its second week as number one on the Billboard album chart. Your thoughts on the soundtrack, Mark?
I was less than impressed by the soundtrack. I understand the importance of having a soundtrack with the film and having someone like Kendrick connected to it. I needed a little bit more gestation period for
him. You mean for listening? Or
for listening, but for him to make it. Because it feels as though it was made very quickly. It would have been nice to have other voices in. I mean, there are multiple voices, but it's still very much Kendrick's platform. So I didn't feel as though the soundtrack actually lives up to the grandioseness of the film.
I mean, I haven't heard the whole soundtrack, but you know, when I heard the SZA song at the, I guess during the first set of credits, at the end of the film, I kind of felt the same way.
Yeah, and that's probably the best song
of the whole thing. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I did feel like there it seemed a little interesting to me that this song would come after, you know, all this power and grandeur. Mm-hmm. You know,
what about the critique that or let me ask you what your opinion is of this film going forward and its ultimate impact? Clearly, it is having an impact today. It's breaking all kinds of records and bringing people into theaters. Is this going to have a lasting impact, Mark?
I think it will. You've seen some of it in how varied the writing about the film has been. Obviously, the ideological pieces around T'Challa and Killmonger. It's kind of almost a Martin Malcolm thing in some ways. I think that's maybe the most superficial conversation to be drawn out of the film. I've been really struck. I mean, when you see that initial view of Wakanda, it's breathtaking. And I think just the way Wakanda is staged will raise many questions in the past about thinking about design. Like, there are no cars in Wakanda, right? How do these elaborate subway systems work? And we start to see some people actually delve into some of that work at places like The Atlantic and City Lab. I think those kind of questions will continue because the film itself is dense. And that's part of the reason why folks are so drawn to the Killmonger and T'Challa conversation, because it, you know, that's right there on the surface. But, you know, there's so many deep layers of conversation, including about, you know, what we think about in terms of women's leadership.
Mm-hmm.
This is still a nation, despite the fact we see it as progressive, Wakanda still presumes male leadership, you know, in the context of it, right? And so it'll be interesting to see what that looks like going down in the future.
Yeah, and I think, to your question about whether or not this is Black Panther will have a lasting effect, you know, it seems to be because of how well it's done at the box office and how audiences have, you know, really, and diverse audiences, right, let me say, have been coming into theaters. I think it is, you know, speaking directly to this idea that people don't want to see stories. They're not interested in stories about Black folks. And that this is challenging that very idea. And it's really saying, hold up. Yes, people are, especially if they're well-crafted, especially if they're given budgets that are going to actually allow the director and, you know, the crew to realize a fully fleshed-out vision of, you know, what any given film can look like. So I think it's going to have, it's challenging so many assumptions about what's possible on a variety of levels. And so I think that's going to be a part of the legacy of it.
But yet that's something that still troubles me. You know, let's imagine for a second that, you know, Wakanda, you know, Donald Trump is president. The success of the Black Panther is as brand new. You know, we're just in a new, different moment. And historically, I've always had some sort of consternation and concern about Black cultural products that outperform our expectations, right? That in some ways, there's actually no logical explanation for its success. You mentioned finding a global audience. You know, we've known for the last 20 years, if it's a film that is Black themed, right, it is dead on arrival outside the United States. I mean, even a film like 12 Years a Slave, right, they had to basically erase the slave, right, in order to sell it to, you know, global audience. How do you explain Black Panther making $200 million? Yeah. And that's not just all Nigerian and Ghanaian money.
Right.
But doesn't this get back to what Natalie said earlier, though? The idea that in fact, I've almost heard this as a critique. It's like, well, obviously, if you have that much star power and that many, you know, great directors and actors and Kendrick Lamar doing the soundtrack, and you put all that together in one film, obviously it's going to... Okay, well, that defines Hollywood. That's pretty much every film that ever succeeds. The difference is, the budgets hadn't been there before. The all-Black cast hadn't been there. The writers and directors all together with the budget to put together that ensemble had not been there before. Had it been, yeah, just like any other Hollywood movie with all those resources and that marketing behind it, it's going
to
win.
And to be honest, Frank, you know, as beautiful as the film is and as much as it's going to change the way that we talk about Africa and the United States, it still is very much a Hollywood film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. I have, to me, CIA agents who are benign and benevolent are unbelievable to me.
Right, right, right.
And that figure struck me as problematic throughout.
Yeah,
I agree. As did this kind of glimpse into the future making of Black Panther and the relationship that you see that's playing out between King T'Challa and the same CIA agent. Those kind of things trouble me in a moment in which we know about the real historical relationship between the CIA destabilizing African nations. You know, let's start with Patrice Lumumba. Mm-hmm. We know about the FBI's relationship to the actual Black Panther Party. They're a generation of people who are growing up seeing the film Black Panther who won't be able to know any of that history because that history has now been replaced.
Mm-hmm. Unless it's a springboard. And again, you sort of count on popular culture. I mean, most of what America thinks about America has come from the movies, you know? I mean, we don't, certainly not based in reality. And any of what you just said isn't a part of their knowledge base is part of. So the fact is we have to count on movies to inform America, to tell the story of America. And maybe this is a springboard. And then some of those other elements get added.
Because if you would ask me 20 years ago, which film would I have rather seen, a film about T'Challa or a film about Fred Hampton, I want a film about Fred Hampton, right? And I don't think we're any closer to getting a film about Fred Hampton made, even as King T'Challa. Right, you know, has generated more than $500 million this far.
That's right.
Well, let's talk about some of the other underrepresentation, which I think is part of the, at least tangential to this conversation. The latest Hollywood diversity report we saw earlier this week shows that while some progress has been made, people of color and women remain underrepresented on every front, like the ratio of white writers to writers of color, 5-1. This is the 2015-16 year. So I don't know. What's your take on whether things are really changing in that regard? In terms of control, Natalie?
I mean, Mark makes just incredible points. He's absolutely right that, it's a problem that we have sort of been conditioned to not expect a film that centers blackness and black people to do well. And I also think he's absolutely right when he says, that in many ways Black Panther is a typical Hollywood film because there were these white characters that were inserted and they feel inserted. You know, they do not feel like they really belong there. And that's clear. So I think it's complicated because there are things about the film that I do believe, I stand by what I said about, I think they challenge some of the assumptions about, what is possible when you fund a black film in Hollywood and you give people the resources to do the same type of work that other filmmakers, mainstream filmmakers are able to do, and you allow us to do our thing.
Yeah.
Their brilliance can come out of that. But we still do it. Like, I mean, I think about Ava DuVernay and Selma. She wasn't given a $200 million budget, and she did that thing. I mean, she made a film that I think, if I remember correctly, outperformed what its budget was. But, we've been doing that, for a long time. So I think, I'm hoping that this film, demonstrates that, we can play. We absolutely can exist on the same level as these other filmmakers.
And maybe this quintessentially Hollywood film lays the groundwork for what really happened to Kwame Nkrumah, and we can find out what happened there and the artist colony that was spawned before the CIA intervened and helped overthrow that democratically elected government.
The movie that I want Ryan Coogler, if he's directing the next Black Panther, I want to find out that Fred Hampton was a Wakandan spy.
That would be great.
I want to see some version of the past where the Wakandans make some contact with the Black Panthers in Oakland to be able to bring that conversation full circle.
Absolutely.
And we know it's something that's there in his mind because it's right there in this film.
Right. Yeah. And I think I just want to add that I think, this is the other thing that is absolutely true. T'Challa, Wakanda, imaginary, right? Afrofuturistic. In many ways, although it draws from reality, a reality that we're not necessarily clear about or that we know about. So I think that Hollywood is willing to invest in something that is not based in historical fact in a way that they would not be willing. So because of that, I'm going to amend what I said a little earlier. And I will say that I think Mark is absolutely right. Until we get to a point where Hollywood will give $200 million to a film about Fred Hampton, then we are still kind of having the same conversation. As long as these characters are fantastic that are black, and not necessarily, you can't really point to something in our present-day culture or history that says, yeah, that's real. I think that that's the difference.
Let's move from Hollywood to TV land and talk about a different black superhero, this one from DC Comics, the first black superhero in DC Comics in a leading role, and that's the new series on CW, Black Lightning. Let's listen to a clip.
It's been 9 years since I've even come close to using my powers.
And each of those 9 years, I've told you this city needs you. So what's next?
What, you mean Black Lightning? There's no next.
Do you remember why you became Black Lightning? You wanted to give the people hope. You wanted the evil that's out there to have something to fear. Right now, there's nothing to fear, and evil's running rampant like a plague through this city. Hell, through this world.
Okay, you know what? Let's cut through the poetry and just talk real. Now, the purpose of Black Lightning was to kill Tobias for literally shoving my father's articles down his throat until he died. Then it was because of crime bosses. Crooked politicians, every small-time street thug that had snatched a purse or robbed a store. You see, there's no end, Gambi. There's no bottom for Black Lightning. And the only loser in all of it is me.
That's a clip from the premiere of Black Lightning, a new series on CW. I'm talking with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. And, of course, the series picks up, begins 9 years after Black Lightning hung up his superhero shield. He didn't really have a shield. But if he had a shield, he would have hung it up 9 years earlier. And now the question is, should I come back, Mark?
Yeah. I think it's important that we get past the narrative of the Black Panther to find out that there are many of these characters that were written. And that we're in a moment now where it's sustainable to be able to support all of these characters and the different platforms and the different narratives. I think it speaks to the diversity, obviously, of the comic industry, but also really pushing towards real diversity in terms of the kind of characters that we see. We still don't see that in terms of gender, right? We've yet to have, like, the Storm television show that we need and the range of those things. But I think in this regard, Black Lightning is an important contribution to the moment that we're in.
And for a variety of reasons. I mean, not just because Black Lightning is black, you know, but there are, I think that the issues that the show seems to be trying to address are important to address. Again, it's so interesting that we can talk about all these different issues within the context of these fantastical characters.
Right.
You know, and when you try and steep the conversations or you try and found them in reality, then that's not always acceptable or appropriate. I think it seems to be the way that Hollywood and television land think about it. But you can do it in the context of a Black Lightning. You can have a conversation about what it means to be black and woman and lesbian. You know, on a show about a superhero, but it's not necessarily going to go over as well in, you know, in other formats.
Well, what about this, that Nafisa Williams' character in this, a leading actress in the show, is a lesbian woman, and that's not central to it. It's almost incidental. So what about representations of, for instance, in her character, a lesbian character as normal and just part of the show? What does that mean?
I mean, I think that speaks to, well, certainly it speaks to, I believe, what the creators, the co-creators, Salim and Mara Brach-Akil, are trying to do, you know, which is to give space for these conversations, but also to celebrate these different aspects of identity, and really talk about what it means to be all of these different things wrapped up in, you know, one person. What does that intersectionality look like? I think it is a vehicle that works. I'll put it that way.
Mark, is it in terms of and black masculinity? Is that called into? Is that in play with characters like this, or is it too?
I think definitely. I think that the character that Kress plays, the fact that he's an educator, is an important kind of different way to think about how the folks who we imagine would be superheroes. Right, we don't imagine him as the mild-mannered guy in the classroom, you know, trying to run a school.
Right.
So I think that's an important intervention. Also, the fact that he's a little older, right? So there's already a kind of maturity invested in him, embedded in him, that we don't normally see among superhero characters.
What about, you talked about issues and it sort of not being in the forefront. In other words, we have to take these fantastical frames, but there are issues that are certainly embedded in the program, police brutality, gang violence, all of that. I want to listen to a clip now, the two lead actresses who are talking about the show's approach to those topics.
I love the fact that in the first few episodes, like, we're tackling marches and police brutality and all of this different stuff, because when you say a black show, those are the types of things you expect to see. Mm-hmm. And those are the types of things you should see, because that's what we're dealing with as a people. So I love that they involved that in the show so early on.
Yeah. And I think we sort of like, we couldn't really have a superhero living in that community and not tackle those things. And that was something that, you know, the producers were committed to from day one, that, you know, we had to talk about those things. And we had to talk about not just like, you know, everyone knows about police brutality. Mm-hmm. We had to talk about stuff that's going on within the black community that maybe people don't necessarily know about.
The crime.
Sex trafficking.
And
or,
the crime,
you know,
within the community.
Black on black crime stuff like that. You know, that's something that sort of doesn't really get spoken about. And certainly I don't think on, you know, like a CW show. Yeah. So it is very bold and it is brave. And I think, you know, it sets us apart from other shows, which is great.
Gina Ann McLean and Christine Adams talking about, they're the leading actresses on the Black Lightning. And they were talking about that very thing. Mark, is this the way in? This is the way to talk about these things using fantastic? I mean, this is what Hollywood and TV do anyway, right?
I mean, it's what we know about shows. We know about the black comedy tradition has been a way that we've been able to talk about serious things. I think comics are one of the spaces now where we can have that conversation where folks don't feel as they're being so attacked for their own personal opinions and things because it's existed in this alternative universe.
Right.
Natalie Bullock Brown, professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's, Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. Part of Back Channel here on The State of Things, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. Please stay with us.
I saw a superhero last night. He was black. He said, "This is for the hood. Black Lightning's back. We pray at night for the helpless. Hoping you get us through breakfast. Wishing somebody come save us. Black Lightning's back. Come to shock the haters."
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and we've been talking about two new takes on black superheroes, Marvel's Black Panther and CW's Black Lightning. We're going to turn the conversation now to talking about a different kind of artistic representation, portraits. The official presidential portraits were unveiled at the National Portrait Gallery last month, and they have drawn strong reaction. The first is First Lady Michelle Obama, and she foreshadowed the controversy at the unveiling.
To paint a portrait of Michelle and Barack Obama is like cooking Thanksgiving dinner for strangers. Everybody has an idea of what Thanksgiving dinner is supposed to taste like. The dressing that you love is the dressing you love. You don't want other stuff in it. And that's what it's like. People know what they feel and think and how they see us. So Amy had to interpret that and do it under the spotlight. So I can only imagine that it's been a little stressful for her, but she has handled it with all with remarkable poise and grace, which I think tells you a lot about who she is.
Michelle Obama talking about the unveiling of the presidential portraits last month. She's talking about Amy Sherrill, who did her portrait. A lot of talk about. I don't remember all this conversation about Laura Bush's portrait.
No, and that's because, you know, these are the first black portraits. And the fact that, you know, both former President Obama and Mrs. Obama chose artists that would present such unique and distinctly different versions of them than the previous portraits raises questions. I mean, we think about Kehinde Wiley not so much as a fine artist, but some sort of bridge between, you know, high art and street art. You know, his work is so much known for taking ordinary black folks and placing them in these majestic and heroic settings. He almost does the opposite with President Obama, right? He takes this majestic figure and places them in very humble settings. You know, that was going to raise certain kind of ire amongst folks who think about portraits looking a certain kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown, you talked about, you mentioned Kehinde Wiley, who did Barack Obama's portrait. Let's listen to what Barack Obama has to say about his portrait.
But what I was always struck by whenever I saw his portraits was the degree to which they challenged our conventional views of power and privilege. And the way that he would take extraordinary care and precision and vision in recognizing the beauty and the grace and the dignity of people who are so often invisible in our lives and put them on a grand stage, on a grand scale, and force us to look and see them in ways that so often they were not.
Former President Barack Obama talking about his choice of artist Kehinde Wiley to paint his presidential portrait. I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. If you think about, you know, what Michelle Obama was saying about the portraits themselves drawing so much attention, right? It's about the Thanksgiving dinner. Think about the choice of artist. Again, in this case, who you choose as artist is going to be, you know, front page news. Right?
Absolutely. I think a lot of, so I think that there is a lot of what Mark was talking about in that, you know, people were, they have this idea of what it's supposed to look like when you do a portrait, right? So there's that's kind of dashed by these artistic renderings of these majestic, you know, basically black royalty. But then you also have people who just, I don't care who would have done Michelle and Barack Obama's portrait. There were going to be people who said, that's just that doesn't look right. Why did you do that? And why did you do that? And I think it says a lot about Barack and Michelle, that they picked the people that they did. They had to know that there was going to be all of this sort of, I'll call it backlash, to these portraits that don't look like portraits. But I think it speaks to who they are. But I think it is so appropriate, though, because they are our first lady and our first black president, right? And so it's appropriate to me. It only makes sense that you'd have black artists interpreting who these people are for all of us.
It was going to Natalie's point, you know, the portraits are going to be disruptive regardless.
That's the word. Yeah.
What I love about Mrs. Obama's choice of Amy Sherrill, you know, Kehinde Wiley is famous. You know, Amy Sherrill is not, right? I mean, she's not a struggling artist. I was shocked to see that. I actually took a picture with her and a group of other artists at Southern Accent 2 years ago, not knowing, you know, who she would become 2 years later. And, you know, there's a way in which her portrait captured what is the kind of ongoing resting side eye that's Michelle Obama's. I mean, it captures that kind of just, you know, not overwhelmed by what the moment was and some real distaste with what it meant and not getting caught up in the moment.
Yep.
You know, that being said, you know, I think about what my colleague Rick Powell said in response to this. These portraits also allow for us to begin to have a conversation about what art criticism is, mm-hmm. and bringing art to every kid. Because so many people had commentary not knowing, well, you know, this is a longer trajectory to right. have this right. conversation.
Right.
It's not just about what you're seeing, right? There's so many things at play in terms of what artists do and what they're trying to convey. And if we actually had stronger art education in this country, mm-hmm. visual and otherwise, right, we might think differently or reacted differently to some of these portraits.
And I just want to say that I also think that part of the backlash comes from people not expecting that Black artists are going to have this art history background, that they're just kind of coming off the top of their head, and that their work is not informed by a long trajectory, right.
or they're not trained,
or they're not trained, and so all of that is, you know, it's a part of the messiness of how people have responded negatively to these portraits.
Well, here's what Amy Sherald had to say, who portrayed Michelle Obama in gray, as she does in many of her paintings of Black people, and here she is talking about that choice in a CBS interview.
Why do you paint Black skin as in grayscale?
It just looked good. Like the gray skin on these bright colors, it just looked good. I think also I was subconsciously struggling with not wanting to be marginalized. And I say that because I feel like the Black body is a political statement in itself, right? So on canvas, all of a sudden I'm making this political statement just because I'm painting brown skin. And I think it matters that these portraits are so different because something happened in history that wasn't supposed to happen. So 300 years from now, when the story's been watered down, you know what I mean? It's like those portraits will speak to that moment with the intensity that is necessary to bring forth the truth.
That's Baltimore artist Amy Sherald talking about her portrait of Michelle Obama with Alex Wagner on CBS. I'm talking with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. It's interesting, too. You know, you talked about a broader context for art criticism that would have to include the social and political milieu as well as the trajectory and genealogy of the art yeah. and the artist that preceded mm-hmm. it as part of it. And Kehinde Wiley was very conscious of all of that when, you know, he gets interviewed. He's all of a sudden the president says, you know, I'd like you to do my portrait. And he thought deeply about that. And here's what he had to say about it.
He asked me about my relationship to power and how it is that I would make a portrait that differs from that power dynamic that exists in my work heretofore. It really came down to, okay, Kehinde, you do a type of transformation. You take people from everyday life and elevate them to a level of dignity and celebration. What happens when you're painting the head of the free world? What happens in your language as an artist when you're dealing with Barack Obama as the subject for this painting? I can't remember exactly what I said, but I would imagine that I assured him that the replacement acts that go on in terms of recognizing the unrecognized can definitely be seen when recognizing an artist like myself for this role as storyteller.
That's artist Kehinde Wiley talking about being chosen to paint the presidential portrait of Barack Obama. We're on Back Channel today, Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. Yeah, let's switch gears here and talk about a new documentary, a PBS documentary about historically Black colleges and universities. It's called Tell Them We Are Rising. It was done by award-winning documentary filmmaker Stanley Nelson. Mark, the documentary traces Black education from the end of slavery to today. And it talks about, I think, in many ways reveals an untold history, or at least an undertold history about Black education in America.
There is some irony that given how long HBCUs have been in existence, that most folks, other than some Black folks, because not even all Black folks
right.
have a good sense of HBCUs, that it's part of that story hasn't been told. I think in many ways, Stanley Nelson is the ideal person to tell the story because his storytelling has always been balanced. He's always wanted all sides of the story involved. And I know sometimes he gets some pushback on that. I know some of the Black Panther folks pushed back on that with his previous film. And there are some folks who felt as though, you know, that the new film spent too much time talking about white folks, you know, who were some of the founding, quote unquote, founders of some of these institutions. But it's an important story because Black folks continue to be trained at HBCUs, undergraduates. You know, so many folks who go on to, quote unquote, change the world who were Black are coming out of these places, which are just fundamentally different educational mm-hmm. spaces than the PWIs that some African-American students have to experience.
Right. I think that the film, you know, without, I'm not sure that this is what Stanley was trying to do, but I think it makes a case for why these schools still matter. Mm-hmm. And that is a, you know, important argument to be made, especially, you know, in light of all of the things that are happening to not only public education, but just, you know, the impact of the Trump administration on education in this country. And you know, just the fact that there are so many Black colleges and universities that are no longer with us, you know, that have closed. Right. You know, so in many ways, this history that Stanley tells, I think it has had or is having the effect of reinvigorating the idea that these places are important. We need to hold on to them. We need to invest in them. We need to go to them. Yeah. You know, so I'm hoping that the film will have that sort of long range impact.
And part of the impact we've seen so far is, right, is an uptick of Black students going deciding to HBCUs. To go. And more importantly, Black students, I'm thinking about the protests that are taking place with Black students at Hampton now, Black students who are going to HBCUs and comfortable in what they want out of their experience, that they're actually trying to push these institutions into the forward, forward into the future, which has also been part of the dynamic of folks not wanting to go to HBCUs in the past.
Right. But what about this tension? And I think I have the two perfect guests here to talk about this, the tension between mainstreaming and making sure that we're represented in other institutions, mainstream institutions, integrated institutions, and providing that space for a special kind of education. I mean, Mark, you don't teach at an HBCU.
Yeah.
And I mean, you could teach at an HBCU. So, but and I think it's important to you that you're at a place like Duke. For reasons that you could probably articulate now.
I think it's always down to personal choice and what you need. You have some kids who don't have the experience of going to school K through 12 with Black kids, and they go to an HBCU and have their first real experience with that. There are kids who don't see Black teachers K through 12,
That's
and the
right.
first Black teachers they might see is at an HBCU. So there's still varying in experience. I don't buy into this idea that somehow if you spend 4 years at an HBCU, you're being protected from what's going on in the world. In many ways, I think you're being better prepared for the reality of that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and I had the experience that Mark just described a few moments ago. I went to a predominantly white institution, a PWI for undergrad, and then I went to Howard. And I had gone to a private school that was 99.9% white from second grade until I graduated from high school. So to go to Howard, you know, this the Mecca, as it's called, right? This is the place where Black folks want to go and have been going for, you know, over a century. It blew my mind. It was exactly the type of experience that I needed to be affirmed in my Blackness after having spent so much time in these white spaces. And I dare say that I would not have been prepared to work with a Ken Burns or teach in some of the places that I've been able to teach if I had not gone to Howard, because I'm not sure I would have had the confidence and the belief in myself as a Black person if I had not had that experience. So that part of HBCU life alone, in many ways, I think is worth its weight in gold, because we are being assaulted, like Black kids in particular, coming through public school, you know, and the No Child Left Behind and all the stuff that goes on in our public education system. They need people who see them and understand what they're going through and who can, you know, basically minister to them and pour into them and say, you can do it, you know, and I've done it. I look like you. I'm telling you what I know, and you know, believe in yourself. You know, basically, I'm about to quote The Wiz the way that I believe in you. You know, so I think that they absolutely are. They continue to be important.
Good stuff. We don't have very much time at all left. Oscars on Sunday. Both of you picked a Jans Ford's documentary, Strong Island. Tell me about that.
Wow, it's such a timely film. It's basically so Jans Ford is an African American filmmaker who has done a documentary about his brother who died at the age of like 22, 23, was killed by a white guy in a over a dispute about a car. essentially. And it's about Yance reckoning with, like, trying to figure out what happened, you know, and trying to make peace with it and get some closure. But also what I think is most poignant about this film is that, like, we're talking about humanity. It really humanizes this family that is torn apart by this thing that happens. And it really says without saying, I think, that white supremacy and racism destroy lives. They destroy these systems, these forces destroy Black lives. And so when you see all the things that kind of come out of this trauma that happens in the life of the Ford family, you know, it's very, you really understand in a powerful way, you know, what all of what we're dealing with in this moment, what we've been dealing with, means and the impact that it has.
It's the intimate impact of Black trauma that we rarely get to see. Black death is always so much of a spectacle. Mm-hmm. This draws back from the spectacle and brings
Absolutely.
Us back to
yeah.
like the personal in regard to this.
Yeah.
Mark Anthony Neal, Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. Natalie Bullock Brown, a Professor of Film and Broadcast Media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Back Channel. You can find us at the web, on the web at stateofthings.org. We're going to leave you now with Mary J. Blige's song Mighty River from Mudbound, also a nominee for Best Original Song. And that's the State of Things for today. I'm Frank Stachel.